That's kind of conversation between the soul. That's conversation between the soul and the night.
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade Derek Davison, and we're very excited to welcome once again to the podcast Penny Von Eschen. Penny's at the University of Virginia, and she's a professor of history and William Arkina Jr. Professor in American Studies. So Penny, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's delightful to be here. Thanks for having me again.
Of course. So we're continuing our discussion of Penny's excellent book, Paradoxes of Nostalgia, Cold War Triumphalism and Global Disorder since 1989. And why don't we start talking about this chapter you had called God, I Miss the Cold War, Busted Containers and Popular Nostalgia, 1993 to 1999. And you start with a discussion of one of Derek's favorite movies, 1997's The Peacemaker. So maybe you could talk a little bit about nuclear
Clooney
weapons.
Clooney is an underrated actor, okay?
Yeah, true. He hasn't gotten the recognition he deserves.
I agree. It's a great film.
So could we talk a little bit about nuclear weapons and nostalgia and what was actually happening once Clinton assumed office?
Oh, absolutely. So clearly, I love the notion of busted containers because the, you know, nuclear weapons, oil, everything had been seen in terms of Cold War geopolitics. It had, you know, all of the where things were contained, the various, you know, well, especially the new agreements to contain nuclear weapons at the end of the Cold War. But this was in a Cold War container. And after the collapse of the Soviet Union, I think there's genuine concern. You know, people are like, oh my God, nobody's guarding these nuclear installations. The scientists are out of jobs. There's a certain level of chaos. And something like the Peacemaker kind of captures that brilliantly because there, you know, you do have stories circulating in the news of, you know, somebody's trying to smuggle uranium in their pocket and, you know, people are carrying these weapons around. So the film imagines the theft of a nuclear device and there's an explosion to divert, you know, to sort of divert it. But anyway, without those details, you've got somebody like who just walks over the mountain, over an unguarded border with this, with a device that's going to blow up New York City. So, and it's one of these, you start to get the phrase in this, what one of the characters says, you know, Russia's an effing mess and, you know, God, I miss the Cold War. And so this starts to articulate the sense that we've got this shadowy world where we don't know where this dangerous stuff is. There's this whole new world of markets where, again, things are getting sold on the black market. Things are moving around. And with all these borders coming down, with all the walls coming down, there's both a celebration of this unfettered free market. Isn't this a great thing? But all sorts of things are out of place and really kind of dangerous. So it really captures that in a really interesting way.
So what did people miss about the Cold War? What is going on when people are saying, I miss the Cold War, and they're enacting these sorts of films? What was the nostalgia here?
Well, the nostalgia that's getting spun out in The Peacemakers, as well as these other films, it again is a really false idea that the world was more safe. We knew exactly who our enemies were. We were safer, and now we don't know where the enemies are. We don't know what's going on. And again, one of the main themes I keep coming back to is there are new dangers, but there's this blanket refusal to look at where the dangers are coming from. So there's the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center, and without getting into a lot of names and organizational details, the bombers could very much be traced to people the CIA had been working with, and the fact that the CIA had been working with them in the earlier trying to undermine the Soviet Union in Afghanistan, and kind of sets up you know, it sets up a cover. So, so people who, and this is what Tomrades Johnson and many other people have talked about as blowback. So the U.S. has set up all sorts of relationships that, you know, where they decided it was a very good idea to fund the most anti-American and most extreme fundamentalist group of people in Afghanistan, and really not taking seriously their anti-Americanism. And so this is really coming back to haunt them, and their ongoing relationships with the CIA allow, really both allow intelligence to look the other way. We could even think about that with 9/11, but it does create some real dangers. And another thing that I trace, and again, I think that, I think the films are actually, they're capturing and articulating a real anxiety and kind of real issues, but, you know, certainly kind of deflecting this, like the politicians, from any real political analysis. One of the things that I think is really needs to be more in our political discourse and the kind of, you know, discussions we have is that after the Soviets left Afghanistan, so the U.S. pulls out, there didn't seem to be a lot of interest, but fairly quickly, they're working with the Taliban in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Why? And I think there's only one answer. It's oil. It's the U.S., the deep interest in Caspian oil. And the United States has this, you know, just is adamant that that they really don't want that oil to be controlled by Russia. So what they start doing in a nutshell is there's a couple different pipeline projects where they're trying to divert that oil so it won't go through Russia, will kind of go straight through either, you know, Pakistan or Afghanistan to the West. And this keeps them working. This keeps them working with the Taliban. Now, it's not that it's not available to people who are paying attention. So really good journalists are watching Dick Cheney, who's soon going to be vice president under George W. and has been defense secretary under his father. So Dick Cheney is in the Caspian. He's working at private, he's now in the private world of oil, and he's really got his sights on this and kind of back to popular culture. So this is really staged really heavily in a Bond film, The World Is Not Enough. So this is, again, all about this fight over Caspian oil. And in this film, Judi Dench, who I just absolutely adore, you know, is Judi Dench has, she's failed somebody because there's a Electra who is the daughter of, who's a daughter of somebody from the Caspian region, but is also of a sort of a British, sort of a British elite. She's been kidnapped, and Judi Dench fails to rescue her properly, and she's fallen in love with her captor. So as this whole thing spins out, Electra is trying to blow up these pipelines and then sabotage this Western project. So we kind of have it out there in James Bond, right? But the story of that film is a story of clash of civilizations. That Electra is betraying the West because she's siding with her mother's ancient indigenous people. And this is presented as completely irrational. And she's doing this because she's fallen in love with her captor. She's completely duped. She's completely irrational. So once again, you've got the dangerous sort of laws of the jungle and people who don't understand logic who are undermining this happy Western project to get that oil through the Caspian. Get the oil through the Caspian, but out of the Caspian Sea region and, into Western hands. So this stuff is really kind of, it's all over the place in popular culture. And another interesting angle here is that as Russia tends to be portrayed as as they reboot the Bond series in all sorts of other films, they tend to be portrayed as in danger of being taken over by ultranationalists and who are then in cahoots with organized crime throughout the world. And on the one hand, certainly conservative ultranationalists certainly had a role there, but that doesn't map on to the politics of Russia at that time at all. So Russia is, Russia's there. They're kind of figuring out like what to do with Russia.
Can we talk a little bit about North Korea? Because you spent quite a bit of time in this chapter talking about, you know, North Korea. And we'll try not to offend Derek, who can't stop talking about Juche communism. But what role does... I'm sorry, Derek. What role does...
Everything I love is being trashed on this episode. I don't understand. Clooney, Nicole Kidman, back when she could move her facial muscles, the North Koreans...
We're a top Derek podcast, but not nice to our Dereks. Penny, can we talk a little bit about North Korea? Because all of a sudden, people start caring a lot about North Korea in the 1990s.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is so important, both because it's broadly overlooked. Certainly not by some fantastic historians that we have, but very overlooked and misunderstood in our broader political culture, and because it really was important. So what I want to assert is that, and again, this would follow, historians like Bruce Cummings, Monica Kim, and many others, that there was a very serious South Korean democracy movement in the 70s and 80s, and the United States had, kind of long propped up South Korean dictatorship. So this is a democracy movement at odds with the United States. The United States, found the allegiance with a highly anti-communist and dictatorial South Korea quite convenient for its purposes in this region. So there's a moment when the Korean War, which is still not over, once again, it was on the table to end the war and reunify South and North Korea. So reunify the country. And I will have to acknowledge, because everybody will always come back, there's still a very strong anti-communist bloc. So we can't speak, and we can't rightly say that that's absolutely the dominant view in South Korea, but it was a very prevalent view. It was a very respectable view. And it's a view that then shaped the later Korean Truth and Reconciliation Commission and shaped the government of the late 1990s and into 2000, the Sunshine Policies. So we have to take seriously that there's tremendous desire on both sides for reunification. So into this steps, again, Dick Cheney. And to make a long story short, it was in Cheney's eyes and in George H.W.'s eyes, it was not in the interest of the United States to have peace or unification on the peninsula. They absolutely wanted the military bases as a bulwark against China. So there was all sorts of ins and outs where first Cheney said, okay, we're going to take the nukes out of North Korea, out of South Korea, but we have to inspect North Korea. And then there's this false alarm. Oh my goodness, they almost have nuclear weapons. They were nowhere close to having nuclear weapons. And this is absolutely true. But the tension around this really almost led to a war. And as I say in the book, the United States is mobilizing, the Clinton administration and his advisors are predicting, well, maybe 50,000 lives lost, at least 10,000 American lives. So diplomacy saves the day. Former President Jimmy Carter and a whole host of other diplomats go in. And I should say, the heroes of this book are really the diplomats, the people who stopped wars from happening, along with the great investigative journalist and the reformers whose visions really lost out. But I would really kind of put the diplomats in there. So they start something called, then they launch an agreed frame. And what the agreed frame would do, and it's not a treaty, it's a frame, but it's going to help North Korea with its, North Korea is suffering terribly. It's lost Soviet subsidies and support. So they don't have energy. So it's going to set up Japan, the United States, and South Korea helping to put together nuclear energy rather than coal, but absolutely not weapon grade, nothing that could remotely be made into weapons. So to make a long story short, and I want to come back to the cultural side, this goes through, and there's a huge division between hawks and diplomats within the U.S. government and the State Department. So the diplomats prevail, but they're constantly being undermined by Congress. The Republican Congress says, okay, you can do that, but we don't have to fund it. So they're constantly a thorn in North Korea's side. Now, culturally, what I find so interesting is that there's an absolute obsession with Korea bashing. Now, of course, as people, you know, this is a regime that's been secretive, as Bruce Cumming points out, you know, they 80% of the country surfaced by U.S. reports was utterly obliterated by U.S. bombs during the Korean War. So why are they paranoid? The whole country was destroyed. There's all sorts of facilities underground. People were forced to underground living. But what's so interesting is that Kim Jong-il, the leader at the time, was very interested in American culture. He had a massive collection of American movies and film, a real film buff, music. And I find it so striking that this was became an object of ridicule within the American media. So normally, somebody's interest in American culture would be, you know, that would be a grounds for opening, like, you know, come and have a state dinner and we'll watch a movie. We have some common ground here. But here it's yet another reason to belittle him, make fun of him. And so, you know, and I go into some of the, you know, some of the very, just as a way of historical documentation, some of the incredibly offensive ridicule. But it's all toward painting this diplomacy as impossible with any kind of, you know, insane, irrational, rogue state. You know, we can't even dream of talking to these people. And that, now as the agreed frame stumbled along, this was completely resuscitated then in 2003 with George W. Bush's Axis of Evil speech, naming North Korea along with Iraq as part of this axis of evil. And I think commentators have rightly said, you know, it was just bizarre. It came out of the blue. There was a sunshine policy. There were really, you know, the agreed frame had been undermined by the U.S. Republicans, but it was still working. There was much better relationships between North and South Korea because of the politician, the Sunshine government had come out of the democracy movement. There was a shared history of anti-colonial struggle that, you know, this was one country. There was a real desire for reunification, but that really, really kind of then blew it out of the water. And then within just a few years, North Korea did have nuclear weapons and did test their nuclear weapons. And in this moment of, again, just a bizarre naming of this country as, you know, as an axis of evil, you then have this very, very ugly kind of popular culture caricatures that are elaborated about North Korea and its leadership. And I think I'm interested in some of the violence and ridicule that come through popular culture and looking at parallels between the kind of the debasement, humiliation, and torture that one sees at Abu Ghraib, and you start to get a kind of a very perverse celebration of cruelty and torture in popular culture.
Penny, I want to ask about that actually, because I think one of the things that goes on in this chapter is there's a lot of casting around for who the next bad guy is going to be. We're looking at central casting. Is it going to be, you know, Russian nationalists? Is it going to be North Korea? And this isn't just, I mean, this is political, but it's also pop culture. Tom Clancy writes about the resurgent Imperial Japanese threat. Like, where's that coming from? The first season of 24 tries to make Serbians out to be the new big bad. There's a lot of this going on. Can you talk a little bit about psychologically what's going on here? Why is there this like intense seeming need to just like flail around looking for the new bad guy?
That's such a good question. And it's not an easy question to answer. I mean, I do try to document that at great length. But I think there's real problems, there's real threats, right? You know, there are nuclear weapons, there's nuclear proliferation, there's threats in the world. And I think the reason it reached such a fever pitched anxiety with this like frantic searching about, is precisely because of the deep obfuscation on the part of politicians and the government about what's really going on. And this, you know, and again, this may seem very pie in the sky to a policy analyst, but if the U.S. had in any way really confronted Cold War policy failings and had said, oh, you know, because we were anti-communist and we wanted to defeat the Soviet Union, we worked with various allies who now do not have our best interests at heart, and here are the actual security threats. But I think by painting this idea of these rogue countries who were utterly irrational, fanatic, were like willing to strike and kill at any turn. And again, that's the language of Anthony Lake and the State Department, is, although, you know, they don't put it that extremely, but it is, they do say rogue nations outside of the family of man. You can't trust them. And that language, again, that's a language of Tom Clancy. So drumming that up both makes people, again, there's all sorts of anxiety. Things are changing. What's going on? It gives some people something very unreal, but something to fasten on. And it also, it makes people susceptible to false claims when later people would claim there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, or the kinds of fearful claims that Bush was touting in his 1999 campaign, 2000 campaign. And it also, again, it really deflects attention away from what actual threats are that really should have been dealt with. So again, it's a failure of both policymaking and intelligence, where people are, you know, failing to account for past actions. And if you can't admit those past actions, how can you then analyze what possible consequences and blowback could be? So, and I think that just happens so systematically, but it does lead to, I mean, I think, you know, people have talked about these kind of, you know, tropes earlier in American culture, but it does, you know, you've got this wildly ambitious kind of hegemonic project. We really should be shaping the world, and it implodes and fails in so many ways. Oops, we kind of misled intelligence about the 93 bombing. Oops, we kind of really blew it on the, you know, on the 9/11 tragic, you know, terrorist attacks. So you've got this, these claims of omnipotence and this project full of hubris that we're going to shape the world when you absolutely can't. And then you get these kind of, right, really just all this energy of like frantic anxiety.
Which I'm very comfortable in, frankly, as an anxious person. That's why I always felt great. Penny, I'd love to talk about actually the next chapter, because this is something that I experienced literally as a teenager. I went to Europe and I went to the famous Monument Park in Budapest. And so this is it's such a great title. It's called Consuming Nostalgia, Lampooning Lenin, Marketing Mao, and the Global Turn to the Right. So could you maybe talk a little bit about what's happening and this sort of kitschification of the Cold War enemy during this moment, and how, though, that actually has serious effects in terms of the far right and how the right wing becomes ever more dominant, increasingly dominant as it was already over the last 30 or so years.
Yeah, thank you. And please feel free to follow up with particular parks. So I was really fascinated. And as I mentioned in our last chat, one of the things that drew me to this project was kind of American fascination and kind of really poking fun at Eastern Bloc Cold War nostalgia and these parks and the kind of kitsch that was circulating, while seemingly, you know, not recognizing all the modes of Western nostalgia. So what I see an arc in the time that I really examined these are really from the beginning. So I think I'll deal with the kitsch in the parks a little bit differently, but because the Eastern Bloc collapsed so quickly, you get various different kinds of modes of nostalgia, and initially it's kind of just from shock. You know, I don't have a job. I don't, like, people are like really in an unmoored world. But by the end of the 90s and the 2000s, you start to get a comeback of consumer products. And some of it's just like, I miss those Sprewell pickles. I want my pickles. I want, and you know, a lot of it is, you know, a lot of it is really playful, but this stuff starts to be, I mean, there's also a period we could say in the 2000s where people are just like maybe offloading old stuff and they want to like sell the communist medals. So you get this period where whether you're in Berlin or St. Petersburg or Vilnius in Lithuania, you've just got tables and tables of medals of, and people are reproducing things. You've got, and I have some of these, you've got the little Trabant cars produced in these adorable miniature plastics. And they're, you know, they're very appealing. You've got all, and a lot of this is done, a lot of this is very parodic. So it's very playful. And there's a sense in which, I mean, I actually find this really interesting. And I don't think that this in and of itself leads to a turn to the right. I think that this is, you know, that kitsch, as I think, you know, to me, the most, you know, really interesting people who have thought about kitsch really talk about, you know, kitsch is kind of, it's an unresolved social contradiction. So in some sense, you might say that this history is never processed. The end of these regimes are never processed. What's lost in terms of, you know, a way of life, in terms of values, just hasn't been processed. So it's like we go to, oh, there's a mug with Lenin on it and they're kind of, you know, making fun of him or not, or all these mugs like commie coffee, like wake up, you know, wake up, smell the revolution. Now, in a lot of the parks, in a lot of these sites, at least as they're initially founded, and I think I was lucky enough to see quite a few of them in a phase of critical inquiry. So, you know, even places where Grūtas Park, sort of what people call Stalin World outside of Vilnius in Lithuania, it started by a mushroom entrepreneur. He's found these statues lying around. He wants to make money. They bring tourists, they bring school children. So, you know, maybe there's not such a lofty political purpose to the park, but what the way they pitch it is like, what do we do with these statues? What, like, how do we debate this past? And they also have some really gorgeous examples of, you know, sort of early Bolshevik art. And so it, you know, and they invite a discussion. So is, should these, are these, a, you know, and a lot of people will say, well, like in like Sobor Park in Budapest, outside of Budapest, statue park, will say overtly, well, we don't want to glorify these communist leaders. We don't want them facing the central, the central squares in Budapest, but we don't want to forget this past. So we're going to put them in a park where we can examine this history. And of course, these take place in really different places with different communist pasts. So in a place like, in some places, you'll have people, they're not primarily glorifying any kind of dictators, and all the Stalin statues have been long gone. So a lot of times it's partisans, it's people who fought against fascism in Spain. It's people who fought against the Nazis. So you get a range of a more complicated communist past. But again, that's gonna vary by site. Now, I think over time, and this goes along with political shifts. So I don't want to suggest that these shifts necessarily came from the parks per se, but by the 2000s, you're getting these strong political movements to ban all images of communism. And so, and this is happening.
I remember that when I was in Hungary, there was discussion of getting rid of the park.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And you get legislation passed that equates communism and Nazism. So this all becomes kind of one blanket thing. And then the symbols, countries like Lithuania and Poland start to ban these symbols. And then they introduce legislation into the EU saying these communist symbols really cannot stand anywhere. And all of these claims, I would suggest, very strongly suggest, these claims go with, these are right-wing projects within these countries that are absolutely determined. They're all inventing a mythic past, and they're all also claiming, they're disavowing any involvement in the Holocaust or earlier pogroms. So there, you know, so, and this is now the law in Poland. Historians will go to jail if they suggest Polish complicity with the Holocaust. So all of a sudden, countries that had complex pasts that had been involved in the Holocaust and pogroms are all claiming that they are innocent victims of communism. And they're as much victims of communism as anybody else was victim of fascism. This is all the same thing. We can absolutely not say otherwise. And one could argue that nostalgia is always dangerous because it could always slip into a simplistic claim of a pristine mythic past. But this is when you can really see this political turn in the mid-2000s where multiple countries then take these official stances that present themselves as victims of communism. And then one of the ironies is that, you know, I didn't see that quite as early in Russia, but then you see Putin not long after kind of presenting Russia as the biggest victim of communism at the time when he will like totally distance himself from any part of the Russian Revolution and then claim an imperial czarist past. But it's not so much unlike Lithuania and other countries hearkening back to a very mythic origin and a very sanitized version of their own histories.
American Prestige is brought to you in partnership with The Nation magazine. Please consider becoming a subscriber at AmericanPrestigePod.com/subscribe. As a subscriber, you'll get access to dozens of exclusive bonus episodes, including breaking news specials, deep dives into regional histories, analysis of movies and video games, and much more. And if you subscribe at the founders level, you'll be able to claim a year digital subscription to The Nation. Thank you for listening, and now back to the show.
Can we talk a little bit about the War on Terror and talk about this great chapter you have titled Patriot Act, Staging the War on Terror from the Spy Museum to Bishkek? Because the Cold War becomes a very crucial reference point throughout the War on Terror of the 2000s and 2010. So how was it invoked? Why was it invoked? What did policymakers get from it? What did other constituencies get from it?
Yeah, thank you. Well, as we see, even before the terrorist attacks of 9/11, we already had this idea circulating that I missed the Cold War because it was safer. We knew who our enemies were. But the shock of 9/11 just greatly elevated that way of thinking. And this, you know, this sense of absolute terror of an unexpected attack. I don't know where this is coming from. And really looking back to, oh, you know, the good old Soviets, that era, you know, these things were really okay. But what you also have is an incredible intelligence failure. And what I find so interesting about the Spy Museum, so this is the International Spy Museum in DC, and it's set up by really a group of former intelligence agents, former CIA people, along with some, you know, some private people. And so it is a elaborate defense of the intelligence industry that trust us, we haven't failed, and an elaborate defense of surveillance, spying, all under the guise of patriotism. So it is a massive propaganda campaign to defend the Patriot Act, to defend all the new agencies, the, you know, utterly bizarre idea to anybody who'd lived through history of Homeland Security, of all of this huge reorganization of the national security state. And it's incredibly clever because it invites people into a really kind of ironic, playful world. Like Peter Ernest, who's like running the museum, has been in the CIA. And he writes, his books are like, I lie for a living. And everything is kind of wink, wink. But it's inviting, it's sort of soliciting Americans as citizens to kind of join the program of celebrating security, surveillance. And I also find it, you know, it plays very fast and loose. It's kind of very ironic about like its constantly, like, you know, like, how do you, I said, like, think about it as an epistemology of lying. How do we know the world? Well, we know the world from lies. And that's very, very cool. And just kind of join us and like nod, nod, wink, wink. And it does everything from, you know, the origins of the country were in spying, and George Washington was like a great, you know, whatever. This is critical to, if this is critical to Washington, it's critical to what we're doing today. It had all these elaborate, I was fascinated by the way it has these kind of cultural practices of participation. So some are really obvious, like you go in, you're given your identity as a spy. So you, here's your, you know, you've got a couple of minutes to study it, and then you're asked a series of questions. And if you fail, you're going to be, you know, taken into this dark room. So that's very predictable, but it also stages, they have so many programs, like they have sleepovers for children. But Operation Spy, one goes in and you join a team in this fake Central Asian country, Kandahar, and you're given this mission. And they tell you, now this is based on a real life problem. This actually happened. So you join this team of strangers, you go in, and you learn that there's an agent and her code name is Topaz. So she's clearly not telling the truth. Something's not adding up. So the upshot of the story, I think, is that, and you're going through this in like real time. You get information, you've got to make a decision. And when it's all over, and I actually did this three times, and the scenarios are different depending upon what the group decides, but it all ends up that, is she a double agent? And there, you know, of course, it involves a nuclear device. After the peacemakers, how could somebody not? After Clooney and Nicole Kidman, everything has to involve a nuclear device, right? So is this, you know, is she helping someone steal this? What's going on? So in the end, it turns out she wasn't betraying the U.S. She was just a dupe. She was trying to innocently help her cousin, who was a member of a terrorist network. So as you go through this, it's, you know, it's real life decisions. It's piped in like Hollywood, like movie. It's actually quite dramatic. A couple times kids started to cry. A couple people had slight nervous breakdowns. So you're going through this visceral, physical experience. And you basically, quote unquote, learn that women from Muslim countries, even if they appear modern and educated, simply cannot be trusted because people in these regions, again, it's clash of civilizations. They're irrational. They're ultimately going to answer to the clan, to the people, to an irrational religious family allegiance. They cannot be part of the modern world. So it's what just struck me about the Spy Museum. On any given, you know, day, you've got these beautiful, utterly free Smithsonian institutions, all sorts of them. And they're practically empty. And people are lining up at the Spy Museum to pay, you know, $15 for admission and then another $18 to do, you know, these crazy reenactments, which, of course, I did myself. You know, so it's just very interesting and very, very elaborate. And so this is still in existence. They moved from, you know, they've moved to a different location that's not quite as central, but it's still, you know, really in central D.C. And I think it's just a very, really striking institution. And I think the Islamophobia that I would see in that particular, in Operation Spy, very subtle, was also echoed in kind of in less subtle programs. They would bring in, you know, they'd have speaker series and bring in supposed experts, you know, to talk about the pathology of the Islamic woman bomber, as they put it. So really a very, very elaborate propaganda arm. I also say that they put out study guides for teachers so you can learn about spying. And one of my favorites is about like how Lucille Ball was, you know, was sort of surveilled during, you know, the McCarthy period. But the upshot is that, well, it was fine because she really didn't do anything wrong. So it's just so, you know, surveillance is just really good for you. And just don't fear it at all.
And do you see those resonances in our culture today as well? I think we are genuinely in the post-war on terror moment. I think COVID was, if we were dating it, I'd probably say COVID had a new national emergency, and now we're right, sort of living in that. So how do you see that affecting things today? But maybe with everything but US-Russia, because we'll talk about US-Russia, but
sure.
And what other realms do you see this sort of nostalgia that dominated during the war on terror continuing to shape things or not, as the case may be?
That is such an interesting question. And I wish we could talk about it for hours because I'd love to know what you think about this. But I think at least in one sense, it's quite different because I think with solidifying with Trump's election, I think the sense of a dominant sense of such a large part of American culture tipped into this sort of xenophobic white nationalism, very parallel to what happened in a lot of other countries. So the idea of Americans being victims just really came to the fore. It's hard to say around that culture. So I'm a little bit more thinking out loud. I mean, and not that I don't talk about this in the book, but I also don't want to say that it's totally resolved. When you look at something like the January 6th insurrection, you've got lots of anti-communist symbols. There's a combination of white nationalist supremacy and sort of the accusation that Biden and George Soros and this whole group of people are in this global cabal, which are going to take over America. And that very much mirrors this fear of a global communist conspiracy. I will say I got an email from our, present governor of Virginia telling just his informational email saying that Chinese communism is determined to take over Virginia. So this idea of the global...
You heard it here first.
Yeah. So this idea of communism, I think, is still... That kind of hysteria is very, very strong. Now, does that go with the nostalgia for that period? I think for a lot of people, it goes along with the nostalgia for military might. But again, it's been more wedded to... a kind of white nationalism. And so we can certainly continue along these lines, but maybe some follow-up questions.
Yeah, let's talk about US-Russia, because I believe that's your last chapter, Spies Are Us, Paradoxes of US-Russian Relations. And this is, of course, really what the Cold War was centered on. I'm still convinced that in most Americans' minds, this is why they have various opinions about Russia today. Not to say Putin's not a horrible person, blah, blah, blah. We all know that. It's so annoying that I even have to say that.
Right.
But why do I have to say it? Putin sucks? Okay. Could we talk a little bit about how US-Russian relations were reshaped in the 1990s and 2000s and 2010s? And I'd love if this could actually segue a little bit into the war in Ukraine and any thoughts you might have. I know you're a historian, totally fine if you don't want to talk about present politics, but it seems like this would have really shaped.
Absolutely.
Great. So let's talk about that and let's conclude on that topic, I think.
I mean, there's quite an evolution in US-Russian relations. And one of the things I point out is, it's extremely frustrating to me, having looked seriously at this history and the history of the Cold War, that that people just tend to conflate, like they kind of take Russia outside of history as if there's just one, Russian dictator, and Putin is the same as Stalin, and they're all the same as Gorbachev, and just kind of miss all these like nuances in Soviet history. But in a nutshell, in the 1990s, after Gorbachev was ousted, and after Yeltsin came to power, I think the U.S. was kind of happy because Yeltsin was kind of seemed all in with the more extreme modes of shock therapy, and Gorbachev had still been working on market reforms, but also wanted the socialism with a human face, and also had, represented a more, anti-militarism, all sorts of projects, environmentalism, things that the George H.W. Bush administration really didn't want to deal with. And very quickly, and this really happened under Yeltsin, this idea these promises that NATO would not expand, and again, nobody ever, they had rejected Havel and Gorbachev's idea of peace, but it was clear that the idea was that, well, Germany is unifying, therefore NATO is going to be part of Germany, but it's not going to expand beyond that. That was a Cold War thing. This very quickly changed. And even by 93, Yeltsin, who was, needless to say, a very ineffectual, incompetent politician, but Yeltsin was furious about this and was then furious about what was going on in Russia. But because he was relatively weak, and I think therefore, sort of could be manipulated by the West, the U.S. continued to favor him. And one of the stories that I tell is, and again, do I know exactly what happened? No. But in a 1996 election, a left party in the Soviet Union that clearly wanted to establish more a balance of social programs. We need social safety nets. They were trying to return to the Soviet Union, but they were trying to return to social programs and away from this extreme shock therapy capitalism. They were far ahead of Yeltsin. And all of a sudden, there was a big turnaround, and which involved American advisors being brought in, a lot of American money poured in. And all of a sudden, Yeltsin wins. And the lore and understanding in Russia is that that he didn't really win. That this was kind of pulled out, not without complicity within Russia, obviously, but it said some people wanted him to win, he wanted to win, but it was really pulled out with Western help, and this was kind of gross interference in Russia. And importantly, there's a Newsweek glossy magazine that kind of tells that story, was prominently displayed in the St. Petersburg Political Museum at the time I last visited in 2017. So this is very much a part of this Putin story of the West betraying Russia. Now, I will say, and again, I also have to say, I'm sorry that I even have to say Putin's a horrible person. And you'll know I think that if you read my book. But Putin's not wrong about that. That doesn't justify his authoritarian turn to the right or for goodness sakes, the invasion of Ukraine. But the betrayal but the broken promises about NATO expanding and undermining Russia. You could also see, like I talked earlier about the Caspian oil, undermining Russia by constantly trying to minimize its power in the region. And one thing I'll mention, because I think, and this was a little bit earlier, but in the 90s, what we all know, what came to be known as the Wolfowitz Doctrine was leaked by the New York Times. And so this was an Undersecretary of Defense, Paul Wolfowitz. And what the doctrine said, really shockingly, is that no counter-hegemonic power that is going to challenge U.S. economic or political hegemony can be allowed to emerge in Europe or the former Soviet Union. And it really lays out kind of the hubris and how big the American plan was. And in reality, I think actions kind of bear that out, that was kind of the guiding principle. So rather than saying to, Russia, well, of course, you've had a long-term relationship with the region of the Caspian, or let's have some, even on open market principles, which I'm, of course, really skeptical about, even on those principles, we could kind of work together openly here. No, we kind of want to shut Russia out of that. We're going to interfere in these elections. So, and what I say, and I know this is like, this is a different vantage point than most people would talk about this. I do find it very interesting that as Putin takes over when Yeltsin collapses and then is elected in 99-2000, and as Putin and George W. Bush come to power at the same time, they're both strongly articulating a nostalgia for empire, and they both come to massively curtail civil liberties within Russia and the United States, respectively. So I actually think it's interesting to look at those parallels. Then what happens is, as countries start to come into NATO in 99, but then that really expands in the 2000, I think that unexpected, there was a promise NATO's not going to expand, that Russia understandably felt threatened with NATO coming to the fore. And the main, you know, the kind of people that I rely on for authority of a sort, I look at Gorbachev's responses because he felt profoundly betrayed by that. And so, you know, and he says the West has an illness, you know, it's because, you know, it's called the winner's history and they betrayed Russia at every stand. But the important American diplomats, the last ambassador to the Soviet Union and other important diplomats of that period, they agreed with Gorbachev. That says that that wasn't the plan. This is not right. This is actually causing an incredible problem. And then Obama attempted a reset with Russia. And Medvedev was then, you know, when in his brief little stint in power before Putin came back in fuller control. But, and I actually think that, I think that was undermined by the hawks within Obama's administration. And this can start to move to Ukraine because in the Obama administration, Biden was part of a Victoria Nuland bloc. There was a very, very anti-Russian, pro-Ukrainian bloc. I think we also have to look at the ways that in those elections, the West, the United States, there was money from foundations tied to the State Department. There's all this like murky, what's an NGO? Where there's money from organizations that worked for the color revolutions. A lot of it's coming to the West. They're pouring money into former Soviet countries, including Ukraine. And that money is having an impact on politics. So I think, you know, of course that's going to lead to resentment. And is it, some really interesting critics of these, and, you know, NGOs, it's like there's a sense, and even with human rights organizations, there's a sense of an imperative to intervene to save lives. But it kind of gives a blanket rationale for interfering in the politics of other countries that's almost as sweeping as a Cold War logic. Like, we have a right and responsibility to go fight communism wherever it is.
That's why ultimately, I think, just very quickly, it's liberalism. It's a particular form of liberalism that became hegemonic at mid-century, I think explains quite a bit of the last 70 plus years of U.S. foreign policy.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. And so, and you're talking about a form of, right, it is a form of liberalism that it's, and what's interesting with Ukraine and even now, it gets rearticulated to a kind of a Cold War hawkishness. But again, go ahead.
No, sorry. I just want to ask you, were you surprised about the liberal and left response to Ukraine so soon after the war on terror, that, you know, everyone during that period, particularly during the Obama and later years, talked about blowback, talked about unintended consequences. And then the first opportunity that arises, people start championing sending U.S. weapons abroad. I mean, maybe I was naive, but I was just a bit surprised about how the quote unquote left got on board with that, or at least too many voices for me to be comfortable. I was just wondering if you had any thoughts about that.
Yes, I was surprised and not. I mean, I was surprised that there were not far more cautionary or critical voices. And I think even if you would say, okay, this is clearly a criminal, barbaric attack on a sovereign country. And so if you're not a pacifist and would say some military support is necessary. Even if one was to say that, I think it should have been in a context of first priority, immediate diplomacy, stop any kind of fighting. We have to look at this in a broader global context of dire environmental climate problems. We have to look at this in terms of a broader overall security. And instead, I wasn't surprised or not. I was horrified by the way this Cold War victor's logic immediately comes up. And, you know, even if it's a slip, Biden saying we need victory, we have regime change, we have to get rid of Putin. This immediate recourse to victor's history. And a lot of people even said, people said to me, well, yeah, this is different. You know, I'm anti-war, but this is different. So once again, falling into like the, you know, support for, I mean, there was a lot of opposition to the first Gulf War or the later war, but so many people said, oh, yeah, yeah, I completely am against war, but this is different because this happened. So we get that same, yeah, a very, very easy recourse to militarism. And, you know, so this time it's going to work. This is just an exception. So, and yeah, it's this logic of exception. Yet again, it's always a logic of exception. And, you know, and it also comes out of a real, oh, just again, not carefully looking at this history at all. I mean, so, and this also liberals more than the left, but propping up, so Zelensky is now the Democratic hero or leader of the world. This is a neoliberal union buster, and, you know, and he, that doesn't mean he should be attacked by Putin, but this war is also enabling a broader organization of paramilitary, fascist, right-wing, racist groups, both, well, in Russia, in the U.S., and in Ukraine. This is profoundly dangerous. And I'm very taken aback by how quickly people kind of jumped on the bandwagon and said, this time's different, and we'll go all out, and we'll think about these things later. Yeah, let's put the environment on the shelf, because it's just really much more important to have a all-out victory over Putin. I just find that completely appalling. And that the climate, you know, that discussion was far more on the table. And it did kind of disappear for about 6 months. It's just like, okay, well, that's later. We'll just deal with that later.
No, that's great. And I just want to point out that, Penny, you and I have denounced Putin, but Derek has been oddly silent. Derek, I know you had a final question. You want to ask it?
Well, I mean, yes. I mean, Penny, I think, you know, people should run out and buy this book. It's an excellent book. It's I think everybody, especially the audience of this show, will find it fascinating. I'm curious, now that we are back in something of a Cold War with Russia and staring at what looks like a new type of Cold War, we have referred to it as the new Cold War on this show, with China. What would you like people to take away from looking back at the previous Cold War and kind of have in their minds as they see the way things are being portrayed, the way the government is talking about these issues, and the way pop culture talks about these issues, as we, you know, kind of head forward into what seems like another go round?
So, to me, I think the takeaway is that there have been very both powerful critics of war, of Cold War, of both military and corporate damage to the environment and the planet, and very, very powerful advocates of multinational cooperation. And I think at this moment, we are profoundly in need of deep diplomacy and cooperation at every possible scale on the planet, global, regional, neighborhoods. And I think any kind of a mentality to rush to any kind of mentality to rush to war rather than elevating diplomatic efforts and multinational cooperation. I mean, it's like, and again, it's still, I mean, it is kind of unbelievable that Trump pulled out of the World Health Organization in the moment of a pandemic, and it's kind of unbelievable to pull out of a Paris, you know, climate accords. But again, there's both a history of that. But I think there's absolutely no future without just a profound level of cooperation and diplomacy. And I think that that we just strongly need to support the voices and advocates for that within global politics, and certainly within U.S. politics, if for citizens and we can vote, and that's our responsibility. So, Eddie, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, Marx said we'd either have the revolution or you know, have the mutual ruin of the contending classes. I think we're in the era of mutual ruin.
Right. Socialism or barbarism? We're in the era of barbarism.
My wacky take, which is that basically we lost in 1914. Once the working classes of Europe fought each other and nationalism proved more powerful than transnational class solidarity, I think you could be like, oh, it's kind of been downhill. And the Soviet Union was rump from the beginning, I think, you know. So I think from a macro perspective, we might just be, we probably lost. That would be my guess. Like as an analyst.
Pessimist
of the intellect.
You might be right, Danny, but I would, if I had more time, I would make a case for contingency. And I think with, you know, contingency, there's always a little, a little hope, a little possibility, a little wiggle room.
There always is. Yeah. So to me, like, I basically don't think the state as such can be captured. Like it was able to be captured 100 years ago. I think it's too complex. It's too decentered. It's too bureaucratized in a sense to like be quote unquote taken over. Like even if like someone quote unquote good somehow won the election, I don't think they'd be able to make many moves. And I think that was a conscious project. Like I talk about in national security, Quinn Slobodian talks about in terms of international economics. I mean, I think there's been a very conscious and very successful de-democratizing. I mean, basically mass politics. I think it's one of the reasons that we have such a wacky contemporary politics is that we still use the language of mass politics when that basically only existed for 15 years between like 1925 and 1940, 41. And since then it's been cut off and repeatedly. And I think that actually explains a lot of like the course of history over the last 70 years. So I'm very, very pessimistic, but there is always contingency. And even if you lost, you still have to keep fighting. So on that happy note, Penny Von Eschen, thank you so much for joining us. Everyone, please buy Paradoxes of Nostalgia. That's the only thing that will end the crisis. Buying Penny's book and also subscribing to American Prestige. You heard it here first. And thank you all for listening. And Penny, thanks so much for coming.
Thank you so much, Danny and Derek. Many, many thanks.